Okay, church history. This, I think, is the 18th lesson, so I'm not sure quite how many are left, not 18 more, most likely, for sure. So, anyway. So, we've been talking here now. We got into Thyatira, the odor of affliction is what it means. We were talking about some of the corruptions, and we were making some light of the alternate birth canal that Mary was supposed to have and those sort of things. And we're talking about the corruptions in the clergy, how that they had to actually forbid at the Council of Toledo, they actually had to forbid the ordination of priests that couldn't read. I mean, is that bad? They also had to forbid higher clergy from beating lower clergy and from forcing lower clergy to carry them around on their shoulders. They had to forbid that. So that gives you some idea of what you're dealing with here. Among the things that come out during this time frame is, we are accustomed to hearing about the Inquisition, the Spanish Inquisition, the torture chambers of the Catholic Church, deeper into the church age and deeper into the Dark Ages. It starts coming out at this juncture. A lot of those things arose out of paganism, heathenism. They became accustomed to thinking that God, or in paganism, the gods, would honor whoever was right in like an argument or dispute, say a property dispute. And so when they didn't have a means to make final judgments on it, they would put them through tortures or what they called ordeals. Some of the tortures were water tortures. Some of them were fire ordeals. And what they would do is if they suspected you were guilty of cheating a guy out of his land, or if you were making a claim that the land was really yours, if it was really yours, they might put in a cauldron of boiling water and throw something in that sinks to the bottom, and then you were supposed to reach into a cauldron of boiling water and pull that object out. And if your arm wasn't burnt, then that meant you were right. That proved your righteousness. The same thing was true with the fire ordeal, where they would literally, either make you walk across, burning coals, or steel or something like that. And of course, if you came out the other side and you weren't burnt to a crisp, then you were good. So literally, they did that all the time. One of the more funny of these, actually, I won't spend much time with this, although I'm going to be reading to you a little bit tonight. I think you'll appreciate it, if not like it. But another of the ordeals they put folks through was the ordeal of the consecrated bread. Of course, this develops and the Catholic Church adopts it more and more. So eventually, it becomes the full-blown Inquisition, where somebody, if they were able to, for a while anyway, hold up under torture, that must mean that only the grace of God could allow somebody to go through that. So they must be not guilty. Now, by the time it's all said and done, it didn't matter whether you were guilty or not. The Catholic Church would torture you and then just kill you regardless if you didn't recant. And sometimes they would still kill you if you recanted, by the way, just so you know. But this one is still, this is ridiculous. They would take the communion wafer, and then they would give you the Eucharist, if you were being questioned about guilt over one thing or other, and say something to this effect: may this body and blood of our Lord Jesus Christ be a judgment to thee this day. And there was a couple of cases, of course, where somebody took the communion wafer, the Eucharist, and then dropped dead. So that proved he was guilty. Now here's an example of somebody proved innocent. And boy, I buy this all the way, just so you know. One author records the case of a monk who boldly received the consecrated host. This was for adultery. But forthwith, when he took it, he got scared, so he confessed his crime. And the host, therefore, slipped out of his navel, complete, and as if he hadn't even chewed it and swallowed it. So he was, you know, his confession helped to heal him. And it was always good. And the wafer came out of his navel, perfectly white and perfectly fine. It's just, I believe it. I do. I believe that. Sure. So all that kind of stuff is going on. There were other punishments that, of course, we've talked about a little bit about. I put them on the board before. I haven't put them up tonight. But among the things that the Catholic Church started doing during this time frame, and it became exacted on kings and everything else, was the whole excommunication thing. Now, I wanted to read you just a little bit of this. They would excommunicate somebody, and by excommunication, that means to exclude somebody from the sacraments. And so if you're a Catholic and you get excluded from the sacraments, what are you? You are lost, right? And so they would do that. A bishop could excommunicate anyone who refused canonical obedience. So when the priest told you to do something and you didn't do it, you risked excommunication. A bishop could only be excommunicated by the Pope, and the Pope, of course, could not be executed by anybody on earth. Of course not. The sentence was often accompanied with the awful curses upon the bodies and souls of the offenders. The popes, as they towered above ordinary bishops, surpassed them in the art of cursing people. So I actually just wanted to read you this. So this guy is keeping a mistress, and so they excommunicate him. Here's the excommunication. This guy was not doing that. They wouldn't punish that. He robbed a monastery, okay? He was accused of robbing a monastery. So he robbed something from the monastery, and this is what was said. Let them be accursed in their bodies, and let their souls be delivered to destruction and perdition and torture. Let them be damned with the damned. Let them be scourged with the ungrateful. Let them perish with the proud. Let them be accursed with the Jews who, seeing the incarnate Christ, did not believe but sought to crucify him. Let them be accursed with the heretics who labored to destroy the church. Let them be accursed with those who blaspheme the name of God. Let them be accursed with those who despair of the mercy of God. Let them be accursed with all those who lie damned in hell. Curse, curse, curse. I mean, they really cursed. Let them be accursed to the four quarters of the earth. To the east be they accursed. In the west, but they be disinherited. In the north, interdicted. In the south, excommunicated. Be they accursed in the daytime, and let them be excommunicated in the nighttime. Accursed be they at home and abroad. Accursed in standing and accursed in sitting. Accursed in eating. Excommunicated in drinking. Accursed in sleeping. Excommunicated in waking. Rah! And it goes on and on and on. And so these guys, I mean, they just enjoyed just cursing people, just so you know. That's excommunication. The next thing, as we've talked about a little bit, was also is anathema. And that meant that you were excluded from all Christian social intercourse. And it makes the offender effectively an outlaw. And so, you know, by the time you're excommunicated and anathematized, you are indeed in sad and bad shape. And finally, there was the interdict, and I know I've discussed it a couple times in short. Allow me just to take a minute here before we go to something else with this. The interdict is the suspension of all religion in an entire district, province, or country. So the Pope has power to interdict an entire country. And what that's supposed to do, that's the rites of burial and marriage, including, you know, everything else. And the bottom line is these things, you know, turned the people against their king. If the king wouldn't do what the Pope wanted him to do, he would interdict the country. And so now people in the country are effectively damned. And so they would eventually rebel against the king, and the Pope would get his way, because the king either had to yield or be thrown out. And so that was the nature of the interdict. I wanted to read you. The Pope employed this fearful weapon against disobedient kings and sacrificed the spiritual comforts of the whole nations to their hierarchical ambitions. Gregory the VII laid the province of Nissen under the interdict because King Boleslaw II had murdered Bishop Stanislaus of Krakow with his own hand. Alexander II applied it to Scotland because the king refused a papal bishop. So the king said, I don't like that bishop, I want him out of the country. And so the Pope put an interdict on him. Innocent III, what a name that for a pope, Innocent III. There were about 8 Innocents, and none of them were, by the way. Innocent III suspended it over France in 1200 because King Philip Augustus had cast off his lawful wife and lived with a concubine. I'm not sure why he even cared about that. But the same pope inflicted this punishment upon England in 1208, hoping to bring King John to terms. That interdict lasted over six years, during the which all religious rites were forbidden to the country. So everybody finally rebelled under King John for that. Now, the way to get out of that was penance. And penance was, is a word probably you guys know, but it is supposed that baptism secures perfect remission of past sins, but not of subsequent sins. And so the idea would be, after you've sinned, then you have to do penance. And penance is described as, you just having to go jump through the hoops to satisfy various things. The sacrament of penance and priestly absolution includes 3 elements: contrition of heart, confession by the mouth, and satisfaction by good works. On these conditions, the priest grants absolution, not simply by a declaratory, but by a judicial act. The good works required are usually fasting and almsgiving. You could be made to make pilgrimages to Jerusalem, Rome, various other places, sacred sites. One pope recommended voluntary self-flagellation, so you scourge yourself, as a means to propitiate God. These pious exercises covered in the popular mind the whole idea of penance. Piety was measured by the quantity of good works rather than by the quality of them. So, say 1,000 Hail Marys, and if you said them, you're good. Doesn't matter whether you're sincere or not. The other thing that happened here that became a major deal in time, and then we'll go to something else, okay, is indulgences. Now, indulgences really are nothing more than an exchange of money. And so for some people, if they had money, it became where they didn't have to go crawl on volcanic rocks to make right their sins for absolution and penance. Instead, they could just give the Pope money. And those indulgences are actually what led Martin Luther to nail up the 95 Theses at the start of the Protestant Reformation. He wasn't looking to, overthrow the Catholic Church. He just wanted to cease indulgences, which is people paying to have their sins forgiven. And so that was actually the beginning of the Protestant Reformation. But that's jumping way ahead. Okay, next we have some things to talk about. And I put this up on the board. The papacy, we're going to talk about that for a while. Some people think the Pope is a relatively harmless little man. And that's not true. The rise of it, again, 300 to 600 A.D., the first real pope about 450 AD in Pope Leo the First. It really grew through the 600s through the 1100s, and then the real power of it was for about 200 years around 1100 to 1300, and then it started the decline. Now, I put these other names up. Notice 850 to 1050, this was really bad. This is known by historians as the midnight of the Dark Ages. And this time frame, there were literally harlots in the papal palace that were bringing forth children for popes and are anointed as the next popes. This is named, this is called the rule of the harlots. And there's another word for it. I'll go ahead and tell you what the word is. And parents, I'll be careful tonight because this doesn't get nasty or anything, but it's frank talk, so I'll be careful. But that time frame is also known as the pornocracy. Not the papacy, but the pornocracy. It's actually a time frame in history. And I wanted to give you, I know that, you know, I don't, you know, I'm not going to apologize for it. I want to give you an idea of just, again, I'm going to be reading a little bit here, just how bad this got. Most people don't know. This book is called A Woman Rides the Beast. It's written by a guy named Dave Hunt. Dave Hunt was a relatively famous evangelical writer. And one thing you got to give him, he wasn't a Bible believer like us, but he got straight the Catholic Church. And this is an excellent book. I'm only going to read a few pages of it. But popes were both installed and deposed by imperial armies or Roman mobs many times. Some were murdered. More than one pope was executed by a jealous husband who found him in a compromising position. Money and or violence most often determined who would be the Peter's successor. No wonder, I'm not going to read that. At times, there were several rivals for the papacy, each claiming to have been legally voted in by a legitimate council. One of the earliest examples of multiple popes, you did know there were several times in history that there was more than one pope. Now, most Catholics don't know that and won't admit it and aren't interested in hearing it. But I thought this was a holy succession from Simon Peter. There was nothing holy about the succession. They bought and sold these offices right and left. There was murder, poison, intrigue, honey traps, if you know what that is, all kinds of things going on. One of the early examples of multiple popes was created by the simultaneous election of rival factions of popes Yersinius and Damasius. The former's followers managed, after much violence, to install him as pope. Later, after a bloody three-day battle, Damasius, with the backing of the emperor, emerged the victor and continued as vicar of Christ for 18 years. So, apostolic succession by an unbroken line from Peter operated by armed force. Really? Right? Stephen the Seventh. And this is back in the 800s, who exhumed Pope Formosus' body and condemned the corpse for heresy at a mock trial, was soon thereafter strangled by zealots who opposed him. His party promptly elected a cardinal, Sergius, to be pope, but he was chased out of Rome by a rival faction which had elected a Romanus as its vicar of Christ. Of the strange manner in which popes followed one another in an unbroken line of apostolic succession from Peter, one historian writes this. Over the next 12 months, four more popes scrambled into the blood-stained papal throne, maintained themselves precariously for a few weeks or even days before being hurled themselves into their graves. We're talking here about murder, poison, all manner of stuff. I mean, so being a pope is dangerous. Anyway, seven popes and an anti-pope had appeared in a little over 6 years when Cardinal Sergius reappeared after 7 years exiled, back now by the swords of a feudal lord who saw a means thereby of gaining entry into Rome. The reigning Pope, Leo V, found his grave. The slaughters in the city reached a climax, and then Cardinal Sergius emerged as Pope Sergius III, sole survivor of the claimants and now supreme pontiff. But it's all by murder and intrigue. And this is just one portion of it. Attempting to establish stability in selecting popes in 1059, Nicholas II defined the role of the cardinals in the papal electoral process. During the Third Lateran Council in 1179, Alexander III restricted papal elections to the cardinals. It was hardly an improvement. As one 19th century historian pointed out, few papal elections, if any, have been other than simoniacal. Remember simony, that phrase? Simony is a word. It means buying a church office, simony. The invention of the sacred college of cardinals has been, on the whole, perhaps the most fertile source of corruption in the church. Many cardinals went to Rome for the conclave to elect a pope with their bankers. So you show up with your banker and you start dickering for the office, or dickering or selling your vote for an office. Much insight into much corruption comes from the diaries of John Burchard, master of ceremonies at the conclave that elected Rodrigo Borgia. Rodrigo Borgia was Pope Alexander VI. He was one of the most depraved dirt bags to ever walk the face of the earth, just so you know. Burchard concludes that only 5 votes were not bought in that election. The young cardinal who didn't vote for the guy, refused to sell his vote, thought it prudent to leave Rome immediately. In those days, a cardinal's hat sold for a king's ransom. So it took a fortune to enter the polluted stream of apostolic succession. Money flowed in from all over Europe to back favorite candidates. Borgia, Pope Alexander VI, bought the papacy with villas, towns, and abbeys. 4 mules loads of silver to his greatest rival to induce him to step down. It is instructive to see by way of Burchard's diaries how the Holy Spirit goes about choosing St. Peter's successor. Now, it gets a little rougher. Some popes were put in office by their mistresses. Now, this would follow along the line of the rule of the harlots. 6 popes were put in office by a mother-daughter pair of prostitutes. Theodora of Rome, wife of a powerful Roman senator, was most successful at this strategy. She manipulated Roman politics by exploiting the fact that her daughter Marozia was the mistress of Pope Sergius III, known as the Mistress of Rome. Marozia did not hesitate at murder to accomplish her ambition. Theodora herself was mistress to 2 ecclesiastics, whom she maneuvered in quick succession after Sergius's death onto Peter's throne. Popes Anastasius III and Lando, in 913. That prostitutes determined who would be pope could hardly be apostolic succession if this remarkable mother and daughter, Edward Gibbon, who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, he's a secular historian, said, "The influence of 2 prostitutes, Marozia and Theodora, was founded on their wealth and beauty, their political and amorous intrigues. The most strenuous of their paramours were rewarded with the Roman mitre, the bastard son, the grandson, and the great-grandson of Marozia, a rare genealogy, were seated in the chair of St. Peter." So she gave birth to a illegitimate son, then her grandson, and then her great-grandson, all were popes. The reign of the harlots. Alberic, mother of Marozia's sons, that's the daughter, with his armed thugs literally controlled Rome. He made the Roman leaders swear to elect his sons, Octavian, not only as his successor to the imperial throne, but upon the death of the Pope, so that the supreme religious office as well. And so it happened that Octavius called himself Pope John the 12th, while at the same time retaining the name Octavian as prince. Thus, both the civil and ecclesiastical thrones were joined in one man, him. John the 12th was obsessed with illicit things, even more than he was with power. Though he had many regular mistresses, they were not enough. It was no longer safe for any woman to come to St. Peter's, bishop somebody of somewhere, papal observer and chronicler of that time, tells that the Pope was so blindly in love with one mistress that he made her a governor of several cities. Even gave her the golden crosses and cups of St. Peter himself. Roman mobs that had supported him and cared nothing about his affairs were angered by the loss of properties which the Romans had looked upon as part of their heritage. And so that kind of just goes on. When, let me slide over here, just picking and choosing here. Chased by mobs from Rome in 1045, Pope Benedict IX fled to the protection of his uncle, Count Gregory, whose army controlled the hill country of Tuscany. In his absence, John, Bishop of the Sabine Hills, entered Rome and installed himself as Pope under the name Sylvester III. He occupied the throne of Peter a mere 3 months until Benedict stormed back with more swords than Sylvester could summon and ruled as Pope once again. Yet both of these men were in the official Vatican list of those considered worthy of the title, His Holiness, the Vicar of Christ. Tiring of the burdens of his office and eager to devote himself entirely to his favorite lover, paramour, Benedict sold the papacy for 1,500 pounds of gold to his godfather, Giovanni Gratiano, and an archpriest of St. John's Church in the Latin at the Latin Gate. Giovanni took over the papacy in May 1045 under the name of Pope Gregory VI. With fresh resolve, Benedict returned to Rome in 1047, set himself up as Pope once again. So did Sylvester III. Now there were three popes, each ruling over that portion of Rome which his private army controlled. Right? Growing weary with the charade, the disillusioned and angry Roman citizens appealed to Emperor Henry III. He marched into Rome with his army, presided over a synod that deposed all three popes, installed the emperor's choice. He called himself Clement II, but Benedict was not so easily dispatched, and soon as the imperial army withdrew, he returned to Rome and managed to by force of arms, to rule as Pope for another 8 months. So much for being subject to the Lord, right? I'm not quite done here. Just give me a second. Like I said, some of this can get a little sordid, so I'm trying to be careful. Not that this guy cusses or says anything raunchy, but I know that there are some kids here. But I mentioned this last time, and I wanted to touch it again. The fact is that priestly celibacy has hardly ever worked. In the view of some historians, it has probably done more harm to morals than any other institution in the West, including prostitution. The proof of the harm done by celibacy comes not from bigoted anti-Catholic sources. On the contrary, it includes papal and conciliar documents and letters of reforming saints. They all point to one direction. Far from being a candle in a naughty world, priestly celibacy has been more often than not a stain on the name of Christianity. One must understand that mandatory celibacy is not taught in the Bible, nor was it practiced by the apostles. This teaching developed as an integral part of the evolving papal system and gradually became essential to it. The concern was not morality, for celibacy proved to be a veritable cornucopia of evil. In fact, the rule of celibacy was not the prohibition of relations, but of marriage. Pope Alexander II, for example, refused to discipline a priest who had committed adultery with his father's second wife because he hadn't committed the sin of matrimony. That was the great evil which had to be eliminated for the priesthood to be totally devoted to the church. All down through history, not only priests and prelates, but popes as well, had their mistresses and visited prostitutes. Many were homosexuals. Imagine that. No member of the clergy was ever excommunicated for illicit relations, but only for being married. Why? By the way, there were thousands that have been put out of the priesthood for the scandal of getting married. Why then the strict insistence upon celibacy, even to the present day? It is, if it really doesn't mean abstinence from relations. It is because the rule of celibacy was a very practical and lucrative result for the church. Did you hear the word lucrative? The love of money is the root, not of all sorts of evil, of all evil. Let me finish the sentence that I interrupted. It leaves priests, and especially bishops, popes, without families to whom to bequeath property and thereby impoverish the church. The clergy must have no heirs. H-E-I-R-S, heirs. Pope Gregory VII, bemoaning the difficulty in stamping out marriage among priests, declared, "The church cannot escape from the clutches of the laity unless the priests first escape from the clutches of their wives." Here is another vital reason for celibacy: to create a priesthood without the encumbrance of wives and children. Thus, fornication, adultery, though forbidden in theory, were preferable to a marriage relationship. It was considered absolutely necessary to the perfect working of the papal system that there should be organized a compact body of ecclesiastics destitute of all those generous sympathies which grow alone out of family relation, that they might be the better fitted to do the work of the popes. I'm picking and choosing what I read here. For centuries, the priesthood was largely hereditary. Most priests were the sons of other priests and bishops. More than one pope was the illegitimate son of a previous and supposedly celibate pope. For example, Pope Silverius, this was in the 500s, was fathered by Pope Hormosus, and John the 11th was fathered by Sergius III by his favorite mistress, Marozia, to whom we referred earlier. Among the other, it's not a dirty word, bastards who ruled the church were Popes Boniface, Gelasius, Agapetus, and Theodore. There were more. Adrian IV was the son of a priest. No wonder Pope Pius II said Rome was the only city, I'm sorry, here it comes. It was the only city run by bastards. The Bible uses the word bastard. Kids don't use it, but just saying, the Bible uses it. Pius himself admitted to fathering at least two illegitimate children by different women, one of them married at the time. The rule of celibacy literally created prostitutes, making Rome the mother of harlots, as the Apostle John foresaw. In his fiery sermon, Savonarola, you've not met him yet, you will, he was actually a hero. In his fiery sermon, Savonarola of Florence, Italy, soon to be martyred, called Rome a harlot ready to sell her favors for coin, and accused the priests of bringing spiritual death upon all their piety consists of spending their nights with harlots, he cried. 1,000, 10,000, 14,000 harlots are few for Rome, for there both men and women are made harlots. Pope Alexander the VI threatened to lay an interdict upon Florence if it did not silence Savonarola. The city rulers obeyed their fear that as a result of the interdict, all the Florentine merchants in Rome would be thrown into jail. The Pope wanted Savonarola brought to Rome for trial as a heretic for screaming about the papacy being what it was. Visiting Germany in the 8th century, St. Boniface found none of the clergy honored their vows of celibacy. He wrote to Pope Zachary, who was ruled in the 700s, young men who spent their youth in rape and adultery were rising to the ranks of the clergy. They were spending their nights, you know what, and then getting up the next morning to celebrate Mass. Bishop Ruthario complained that if he excommunicated unchaste priests, there would be none left to administer the sacraments. If he excluded bastards, as canon law demanded, not even boys would be. There would not be no boys left. So I would say it got pretty bad. Amen? I won't keep going forever here. Just give me another second. John the 12th, to whom we referred earlier, became pope at age 16, ran a harem in the Lateran Palace, lived a life of evil that passes imagination, even toasting the devil in front of St. Peter's altar. Spiritual leader of the church for 8 years, John the 12th was in a relationship with his mother and any other woman he could get his hands on. Women were warned not to venture into St. John Lateran Church. Of this man, one historian writes, Pope John is the enemy of all things. The palace of the Lateran that once sheltered saints and is now a harlot's brothel will never forget his union with his father's wench, the sister of the other concubine. Women fear to come and pray at the thresholds of the holy apostles, for they have heard how John a little time ago took women pilgrims by force, etc. Saint Damian's 11th century record of the incredible evils caused by the pledge of celibacy made such scandalous reading that the Pope, with whom he shared it, preserved it in the papal archives. In fact, it proves that profligacy among the clergy at the time was universal. After 6 centuries of strenuous efforts to impose celibacy, the clergy were a menace to the wives and young women of the parish in which they were sent. Pope Innocent IV, forced to leave Rome by Emperor Frederick II, took refuge along with his curia in Lyons, France. Upon the Pope's return to Rome after Frederick's death, Cardinal Hugo wrote a letter thanking the people of Lyons. He reminded them that they had also owed a debt to the Pope and his court who took refuge there. Here it comes. His remarks provide a glimpse of the shameless depravity of the papal court. During our residence in your city, he writes, we, the Roman Curia, have been of very charitable assistance to you. On our arrival, we found scarcely 3 or 4 purchasable sisters of love. While at our departure, we leave you, so to say, one brothel that extends from the western to the eastern gate. Don't make me read that again. You got it, right? It's pretty bad. Let me see how much more I want to do here. Again, Pope Boniface VIII did not hesitate to have both mother and daughter as mistresses together. Pope John the 22nd, the 1300s, had a son who was raised a cardinal. Like Luther, England's John Colet had been shocked at the brazen ungodliness of the Pope and cardinals when he visited Rome. From his pulpit in London, St. Paul's Cathedral, which he was the dean, Colet thundered his disapproval. Oh, the abominable impiety of those miserable priests, of whom this age contains a great multitude, who fear not to rush from a harlot unto the temple of the church, to the altars of Christ, to the sacraments and the mysteries of God. So I'm not trying to gross anybody out. I'm not trying to get too. It's just that it's worse than anybody ever says in public, right? It's just history. Pope Sixtus the Fourth charged Rome's numerous brothels with a church tax. Then he gathered more wealth still by charging a tax on mistresses kept by the priests. Durant, a historian, says there were 6,800 registered prostitutes in Rome in 1490, not counting clandestine practitioners, in a population of some 90,000. In Venice, the census of 1509 reported 12,000 prostitutes in the population of some 300,000. And all of this equaled tax money for the Pope. So again, I'm not trying to gross you out or anything, but this is just continuing on here. You need to probably grab this book. It's called Woman Rides the Beast by Dave Hunt. And he just goes on and on. So I didn't intend to bring the bring you down here tonight. But any questions or comments? Yes, sir, Brother Knight.